welcome back to the American Revolution Podcast. Now, it's been a few weeks, and I apologize for that, but let's just say my work schedule has been none too giving when it comes to me trying to work my podcast. And with my best friend's wedding 2 weeks ago, I had no time to myself to get writing and recording. But we're back. So, in my absence, I very much apologize, but we're going to pick up where we left off. So we are now at episode 8, John Adams. So I told you guys that I was very interested in doing character studies. A look at someone in the Revolution that was an important character for their contribution to the war effort, whether it be for the American side or the British side. I'm actually going to cover both sides. I feel that there are a lot of British characters that are very, very important to our story, whether they were, you know, for or against us. So my first choice is John Adams. I thought because of us talking last week about the Boston Massacre and talking about the trial of those redcoats under arrest, I thought this would be a perfect time to introduce our first character study, and it's going to be John Adams. Now, a lot of people are probably asking, well, why not George Washington? He was such a big character. This is true. But George Washington hasn't shown up yet. See, well, actually, technically he did. I'll give you guys that one. He showed up in the French and Indian War. And when someone else does a French and Indian War podcast, or maybe I do it myself in the far, far future, I'll lead with talking about George Washington. But for right now, I am really concentrating on our story, and in our story, one of the first major characters that we run into is John Adams. So John Adams is born in the Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1735. He had a humble upbringing. His father, John Adams Sr., was a minister as well as a town councilman, and he also farmed the family's land that was just outside the city. When John Adams the Younger turned 16, he attended Harvard, where he studied the law. But when the French and Indian War broke out, Adams had to struggle with his conscience. You see, he wanted to join the fight, but he had a responsibility to his family, and he decided to finish school. So, the war ends. John Adams has graduated school as a lawyer and is starting to grow his own practice. In 1764, he will marry his third cousin, Abigail Smith. Now, a lot of people always say, oh my God, this person married their cousin. That's so gross. You have to understand the time period. The time period, the Massachusetts Bay Colony, though a large colony, probably one of the largest, seconded only to Virginia and maybe New York, Massachusetts Bay Colony was still several maybe tens of thousands of people. There wasn't a lot of people that were living in the area. So it wasn't uncommon for you to marry someone of a distant relation, a second, third, fourth, you know, relation. So we don't judge our early founding fathers on who their life partners are because, let's face it, there wasn't really a whole lot. Now, I will tell you that if you were going to pick a wife, you did a really fine job with Abigail Adams, and I will hopefully be able to introduce her in her own personal character study in the future. But for now, let's talk about the couple themselves. They would have six kids, one of which, of course, being a future president himself, John Quincy Adams. But early on, John Adams, the junior and also senior, I guess how you work that, the John Adams that we care about, considered himself a patriot. Though not as radical as his cousin, Sam Adams, he would write an impassioned letter protesting the Stamp Act in 1765. It is known as the Braintree Instructions. It was a letter that was to be sent to the town meeting in Braintree, Massachusetts, just outside the city of Boston, where they were discussing what to do about the current problem, the Stamp Act. It was very similar to the Virginia Resolves in the fact that John Adams pens it as a letter enticing those patriots in Massachusetts to stand up and say no to Parliament and this taxation that they're putting on the American colonies. They need to, you know, not tax the American colonies at will, but give them a representative body in their parliament to maybe decide on taxes themselves, or better yet, let them do internal taxes and handle it within the colonies themselves. So we all know what happens to the Stamp Act. And as the years go on, we bring ourselves now to 1770, where one morning there's a knock at his office door, and a man calls on him to speak to his clients that are locked up in prison. Those clients would be the 8 redcoats charged with a murder for the Boston Massacre. Now, John Adams is very hesitant to take the case. You see, taking a high-profile case like this had a very strong possibility he could get a lot of backlash, and it would very much hurt his reputation and his practice within the city of Boston. But he takes the case anyway, and as we know, he earns acquittals for all but 2 of the 8. 6 will go free. The other 2 will be charged with manslaughter. It's a lesser charge, but they're actually going to serve it, and they're going to serve it over in England. So he actually saves all 8 of them from hanging in Boston Square. Now, what I really didn't talk about last week is John Adams' speech that he makes about innocence at the trial. It is far more important that innocence be protected than it is that guilt be punished. For guilt and crimes are so frequent in this world that they cannot be all punished. But if innocence itself is brought to the bar and condemned, perhaps to die, then the citizens will say, whether I do good or whether I do evil is immaterial, for innocence itself is no protection. And if such an idea as that were to take hold in the mind of the citizen, that would be the end of security whatsoever. Now, that is a powerful and compelling speech, because John Adams is talking about the death of innocence. He's viewing the British soldiers as innocent themselves. He believes that the night that the Boston Massacre happened, events transpired prior to them firing their weapons into the crowd that caused them to believe that they themselves were in danger. Now, we've talked about it at length, but we're going to review it real quickly. You had 8 British soldiers, and you had a mob of Boston Patriots, and they're looking for a fight, basically. And so when they start throwing things at the British soldiers, and one soldier falls down and accidentally discharges his weapon, the others have no reason to believe that they themselves are not being shot at, so they begin to fire into the crowd. And all of that put together makes John Adams believe that this whole thing was a big misunderstanding, and in fact, that these men were innocent. We see this a lot today, and I'm not going to talk about current day politics, but when our today British soldier, if we're going to, you know, compare it to the past, fires on a civilian that they believe is being hostile towards them. Well, there's an inquiry, there's a trial, and these men had to stand trial. But the court found it to believe that these men were innocent. And John Adams, though he does not agree with the British Parliament, the British government, or even he may not even agree with these British redcoats, he believes that innocence is what has to be protected and not the British soldiers. So with an acquittal, He was extremely worried that his law practice was going to falter. In fact, it doesn't do that at all. There is a boom in his law practice. So much so that John Adams will actually move his family to Braintree, what we will know today as Quincy, Massachusetts. The town was renamed to Quincy not too long after the former president had left office. So the Adams family is living in Braintree at the family home. It is actually a visitable site for the National Park Service. And John Adams will actually keep an office in Boston for his business. It's actually great for him. He is quoted in saying that here he could work and not be tempted by the distraction of a family. What he basically means is what father doesn't want to spend time with his son being a father? But to him, his Puritan-esque values will tell him that it's important to take care of his family and to make sure that they're well looked after. So he spends a good percentage of his time in his office in Boston. And through the Tea Party and intolerable acts, John Adams will continue to practice law and fight for the rights of men to a just and fair trial by jury. With the court system the way it was in the colonies, which was an outdated magistrate system brought over from Europe, John Adams wants a trial by jury system, men to be tried by their peers, men of similar social rank, social stature, similar race, similar religion. All these things are the basis of our court system today, and he was a big proponent of it. Now, in 1774, he's going to be elected to the First Continental Congress, along with his cousin Sam Adams and Thomas Cushing and Robert Treat Paine. The four gentlemen from Massachusetts will go to the First Continental Congress, where John Adams will continue to fight the good fight for his ideals of a representative government and to have a trial by jury. But by the Second Continental Congress, John Adams would press the issue for independence. So much so that he's going to work on a little document along with Benjamin Franklin and a young, wet-behind-the-ears politician from Virginia, Thomas Jefferson. They would author the document that would be signed by the representatives of the Second Continental Congress that we know today as the Declaration of Independence. It was a piece of paper that we are going to talk about at a far greater length later on, along with the both Continental Congresses. I don't want people to think that I'm just glossing over these important things. When I do these character studies, I'm trying to keep the same basic time frame that I am for all the other episodes, but I'm talking about a person's life. So I'm just hitting the little points very quickly. Notice how I spent more time talking about John Adams in the early years, and now I'm just hitting bullet points that we're going to get to later on in our story. So also at the Second Continental Congress, a gentleman is elected to lead the Continental Army, and that would be George Washington, elected in part by John Adams as well. Now everyone is probably going to wonder, well, why'd you start with John Adams? And why didn't you start with George Washington? He's the more famous, you know, guy out of the Revolution. It's like, he is, but he hasn't shown up in the story yet. John Adams has been involved in our story so far, whereas George Washington, at this point, where we are in early 1770s, George Washington is still on his farm at Mount Vernon, Virginia. John Adams is still fighting the good fight in the Boston streets, in letters to the king, in documentation, along with his cousin who's fighting it in a little more radical of a way, but they're still fighting the fight. So George Washington is to come, and so are many others, but I wanted to start here because I thought after the Boston Massacre that John Adams was a positive choice. So the war years for John Adams are going to be not spent so much so in America, that he will be here until 1776, early 1777, but he'll be here, but he'll be overseas by 1777, where he will be working with Benjamin Franklin and the French court to secure French support for the Americans. Now, we're going to talk about the French support as well and their time over there, but we know that the French come in to help us. And after he basically accomplishes his mission in France, he then decides to take on the Netherlands. One, to hope for their support in the war, but they don't have much of a standing army to really lend to the American colonies. But what they do have is money, and lots of it. Dutch banks were well known throughout colonial times. And so they're going to seek help from the Dutch banks to pay off this war effort that we're right now embroiled in with Britain. So John Adams goes there, and he will try and secure some hard currency for us. But with the war, with the end of the war, and spoiler alert, America wins, John Adams is not finished in America. He'll actually become the ambassador to the court of St. James between 1785 and 1788. He would help to negotiate the peace treaty, of course, between America and Britain. But then he returns to America after his time as an ambassador because they've, well, bestowed a great honor on him. He's being added to the ballot to be elected president. Now, early on in America's history, I should say, the president is elected, and so is the vice president. You have the president who gets the most votes, and then you have the vice president who gets the second most votes. So John Adams would work as vice president for 8 years under George Washington. He would actually say that they're some of his most frustrating, because for a man as smart and the vigor and experiences that Adams has gone through, he feels kind of just like a log floating down river. He's kind of going with the flow. He's not imparting any kind of change. But that will change, interestingly enough, because after two terms, something that we now have legally binding in our Constitution, but something that George Washington said, you know, was a proper amount of time. 8 years for a president is the proper amount of time. And no one really went over that until World War II with FDR. So for two terms, Washington is president. And at the end of his terms, we have to elect our second president. And the American people saw fit to elect John Adams. He'll be elected, and Thomas Jefferson is elected as VP. And while in office, Adams had to deal with a real big problem, a war between French and England. I mean, honestly, people, is anyone surprised that France and England are fighting? If you're a armchair historian and you're surprised about England and France fighting over something, then really get out of your armchair and go find another activity, because this is something that's happened 1,000 times before. Now, the Americans had to deal with the French privateers raiding all over the Atlantic and disrupting their supply and trade routes. So though Adams never called for all-out war, he did appropriate funds to enhance the Navy. And with those funds, he would build up a Navy that would, by 1800, clear the sea lanes, and a total war was avoided. But with his lack of aggressiveness towards the French and the British over the issue of capture of merchant ships, John Adams has a real split he has to deal with. Well, you have Thomas Jefferson, who's part of the Democratic Republicans, probably better associated with the Republican Party today. That's probably their forebearer. And the Federalists, which were John Adams' party. Now, half of the party was very much in favor of what Adams did. The other half was not. The other half wanted us to take the fight to them. And because they didn't, they would actually have a party split. And because of that split, there wasn't a unified vote. And John Adams misses being voted in by only a small margin. And Thomas Jefferson is elected to our third president. After Jefferson is elected, Adams would retire to his family home in Quincy, Massachusetts. It is here where he'll continue to correspond with his old friend, Thomas Jefferson. Though they had some years of rough patches and where they didn't get along after his fallout from political life, as the years go on, Jefferson and Adams would continue that friendship that they had throughout the war years. And it is on this day, July 4th, 1826, lying on his bed, that John Adams would say, "At least Jefferson survives," and then passes into history. But little did he know that Thomas Jefferson had died hours earlier at his home in Monticello. So the two friends, two allies, two comrades, two presidents would pass to history on the same day, the same year, at very near the same time. So for next week, I have planned the Boston Tea Party and the Tea Act. And we're going to look at why the Tea Act angered the American colonists so much that they felt the need to dress up like Indians and dump it in Boston Harbor. Now, for today's book recommendation, I really thought there was only one good option. And this man, now I haven't personally read this one, but I think we all know it by reputation. I mean, heck, it won a Pulitzer Prize. If it wins a Pulitzer Prize, folks, I can tell you, you don't need my seal of approval on it. You've already gotten the world's seal of approval on it. And that is simply titled John Adams by David McCulloch. It is basically the expanded version of what we were talking about. I gave you the cliff notes, the high points, the revolutionary points of John Adams' life. McCulloch gives you wonderful and deep detail about it. Now, I haven't read this particular one, but I have read The Bridge and part of 1776, and both are fantastic. So his writing is approachable and easy to understand for the most scholarly and the most non-historical fans of history. So everyone will be able to understand what is going on when reading this book. So that's actually going to take it to the end of our show this week. So till next week, and I promise I will be here next week, always remember, keep your powder dry.